Okay. Wir hatten J-Kopplung. Ah, so, now, English. We discussed J-coupling. And this J-coupling could be understood as we have a doublet, and the two lines of this signal of a spin I come from the spin S, either are in the alpha or in the beta state. And so instead of having one vector in the case of an uncoupled system, we now have two vectors. The circle has now a radius of 0.5. With one vector, it had a radius of 1. And due to coupling, which has a operator, which has an operator that is described by 2 pi j I s I z s z, that evolves in time. The two vectors evolve, and the one vector, the yellow vector, evolves with plus pi j, and the blue vector of the spin I evolves with minus pi j. The distance between these two lines is 2 pi j. And I said that you never see the 2 pi because it's being taken care of in the software, so it is kind of calculated correctly. And then eventually, after a period that I give that I describe in a minute, the two vectors point in opposite direction, and then waiting for the same amount of these two periods, then the vectors are again pointing in the same direction. And we discussed that here I can detect signal in this state. I have signal because the two vectors coherently point in the same direction, and the magnetic field that this vector sends out is identical to the magnetic, in orientation, is identical to the magnetic field that the blue vector sends out. While here, the two vectors send their magnetic field in 180-degree opposite direction, and so this cancels. So here I have no signal. And then comes the surprise that the signal comes back. So this is called an echo. And when these two vectors point in the same direction, I have in phase. And when they point in opposite direction, I have antiphase. And now I'd like to, so the surprise or so is that Okay, how long does it take to go to this point? So the time period needed, delta, is 1 over 2j. And then it takes another 1 over 2j to go back. So if the coupling is 10 hertz, then 1 over j is 1 over 10 hertz is 100 milliseconds. So after 50 milliseconds, I have no signal. And then after 100 milliseconds, it's back. 150 milliseconds, it's gone. 200 milliseconds, it's back. Okay? Now, this is echo. And echo is something that that has fascinated people, echoes. And I guess you all have read Ovid's Metamorphoses. But for those that have not, I copied this from Wikipedia because it's so very nice that I want to share this. Machen wir es besser so. And that's only in German, so I switch into German. Also die Echo, die sollte sich mit Hera unterhalten, damit Zeus Zeit findet für amoröse Abenteuer. Hera ist ja die Gattin von Zeus und Hera merkte das dann irgendwann, dass der Zeus da ein nicht so ganz nettes Spiel mit ihr treibt und beraubte der Echo zur Strafe der Sprache und ließ ihr lediglich die Fähigkeit, die letzten an sie gerichteten Worte zu wiederholen. Und jetzt lebt Echo im Wald und Narziss kommt und gesteht ihr ihre Liebe. Und jetzt kommt's. Und das also eines Tages jedoch, als Narziss im Wald auf Fischjagd war, wurde er von seinen Gefährten getrennt. Echo folgte ihm leise durch das Unterholz, konnte aber selbst kein sinnvolles Gespräch beginnen. Endlich rief Narziss: Ist jemand hier? Hier, hier, antwortete Echo zur Verwunderung des Narziss, der niemanden sehen konnte. Komm, komm, komm. Warum meidest du mich? Meidest du mich? Meidest du mich? Lass uns hier zusammenkommen. Hier zusammenkommen, wiederholte Echo und traf mit ausgestreckten Armen zwischen den Bäumen hervor. Doch Narziss verschmähte grausam ihre Umarmung und Echo fühlte sich so elend und gedemütigt, dass sie sich in einer Höhle versteckte, keine Nahrung mehr zu sich nahm und schließlich verkümmerte. Ihre hageren Gebeine wurden zu den Felsen, die das Echo zurückwarfen, jedoch zugleich das Aussehen einer wunderschönen jungen Frau haben. Das ist also Echo und mit NMR macht man Referenz. So with NMR you give reference to this episode in Greek mythology, and so you have spin echoes. Now we then discussed last time how we can describe when we apply pulses, what happens with J coupling. And I want to repeat this, and these are now elements in NMR experiments that are important. So you have elements that go like delta half, 180 degree pulse, also called pi pulse, and delta half. And so we have to calculate, and we did this last time, and I just repeat this, what happens with chemical shift of spin I, with chemical shift of spin S, with coupling between two I spins, and with coupling between I and S. So to give a little beef into what I'm saying, so I could, for example, be a proton. S could be carbon. And then the J coupling is I1, I2 is proton-proton coupling, homonuclear coupling. And JIS is heteronuclear coupling. Now, let's first repeat what happens in such a sequence with chemical shift of the I spin. And there are three ways of describing this. The one is what you like, is sort of going to this vector model and explaining what happens in the vector model. So for chemical shift, we need a single vector. And that evolves chemical shift. So the operator that acts on the spin is the chemical shift operator that's represented by IZ. It's an operator, so it has this this symbol above it. And the frequency by which it rotates the vector is omega for time t. So it is here. And then we apply a 180 degree pulse from the direction x, which puts the vector here. It rotates the vector along the x-axis. And then the vector continues to rotate with the same frequency. And so after t equals another delta half, the vector is back at its origin. So that was sort of the vector description of what happens with chemical difference. Now the equation description starts with Ix. And chemical shift evolves for Ix cosine omega t plus Iy sine omega t. And for t, I set delta half. And we remember that this is just the vector decomposition into its sine and cosine components. So the yellow is the cosine component, the blue is the sine component. And now I apply the 180 degree pulse from direction x. And an x pulse does nothing to x, so the first term is not changed, while the second term is inverted. And now I did this nice mathematical trick, namely, say that for cosine, f of x equals f of minus x, and for sine f of x equals minus f of minus x. So this term is identical to ix cosine minus omega delta half plus iy sine minus omega delta half. And that was y is missing. Thank you. And that was a Zeitumkehr, time reversal. And if I reverse the time and let time fly again for the same amount of time, then I come back to the origin. So this is the second way of explaining this. And the third way, if you accept, this is the most easiest way of looking at it. Let me try to explain this. And the way you can also understand what happens if you apply a 180-degree pulse on the magnetization is if you look what a 180-degree pulse does on the operator. So the effect bear with me for some minutes. I start and then I try to re-explain. So the operator of chemical shift is this IZ operator. And if I apply a 180-degree pulse from X onto the IZ operator, I get minus the operator. The operator induces a rotation of the magnetization along the x-axis with frequency omega. So after having applied a 180-degree pulse, the magnetization rotates in the other direction. I explain again, different words. Go back more fundamental. So we had the vector in the static magnetic field that rotates. We transformed in the rotating coordinate system. The vector was static in the rotating coordinate system, but for its chemical shift. So, a vector rotates three lines. This one was on resonance, does not rotate. This one is off resonance, rotates with 200 hertz. This one rotates with minus 300 hertz, for example. We applied a pulse, 90 degree pulse, and the vector was along, for example, y. And then this vector rotates in the xy plane because it feels the main magnetic field. And the main magnetic field induces a rotation in the plane that is orthogonal to the main field. So the B not Z field, B zero Z field, induces rotation in XY plane. You remember? Okay? Now I describe this induced rotation by this operator. This operator induces a rotation around the Z field. So, quantum mechanics means the IZ operator induces rotation in XY plane. XY plane is orthogonal, senkrecht auf, is orthogonal to Z. Okay? Now, the rotation frequency is omega. It's the chemical shift. If you're on resonance, it's zero. If you're off resonance, it can be a positive number, plus 200 hertz. If you're right from middle of the spectrum, it's minus 300 hertz. Okay? And now, in order to understand what happens if I apply a 180 degree pulse, I can look what happens if I apply this 180 degree pulse on the operator. And application of a 180 degree pulse from X onto Z inverts this term, which means that after the 180 degree pulse, the magnetization rotates in the other direction. I'm basically, if my IZ operator was before the 180 degree pulse parallel to Z, then after the 180 degree pulse, it's the other direction. So the magnetization starts to rotate in the other direction. Okay? Now, that means if I apply a 180 degree pulse symmetrically in the middle of two identical time periods, then I have refocused chemical shift. Okay? So from here you see that it's all consistent. It should be okay, or should be fine, understandable. Now let's see what happens if we get... I'm not explaining this third way of looking at the effect of 180 degree pulses just to have a third way of explaining the same thing. I now want to apply that to J coupling, because there it becomes much more easy to look at it this way. Do you have questions? Do you feel happy? Nee, es ist in der amerikanischen Verfassung ist das ja ein Grundrecht, Pursuit of Happiness. So the elements so the elements in NMR EPR experiments are, for example, this one, or this one, or this one. And we always now let's look for omega I. I have an I spin and an S spin. So if I apply a pulse on I spin, then only the I spin is affected. And so I do something for the chemical shift in sequence A or in sequence C. And we just had this. I say now pi pulse on, I say pi pulse from X on IZ leads to inversion of IZ. So that means chemical shift is refocused. With the same token, in B and C, these sequences, I now have to say, it's a pi pulse, 180 degree pulse on spin I. And if I apply a pi pulse from X on spin S, then I invert the chemical shift of spin S. So chemical shift of S spin is refocused. J coupling between spin I and S is described by 2 pi J I Z S Z. If I apply a pi pulse from X on I, then in this product term, IZSZ, the pulse on spin I only does something to the I spin, not to the S spin. So I get minus 2 pi J IZSZ. That means J coupling between I and S is refocused. By the same token, I can also apply a pi pulse from X on spin S. So this is this situation. I get the same. Doesn't matter whether I invert one or the other. So the coupling is refocused. Now I have this situation where I apply two 180 degree pulses, which I have to I write down which situations this actually implies. So pi pulse on x on I spin was A and C. Pi pulse from x on S spin is B and C. This is A and C. This is just one pulse is A. Just one pulse is B. And now I have situation C, where I apply two 180 degree pulses. So then I have 180 degree pulse on S and 180 degree pulse on I. And now I invert twice. I first invert the IZ operator and then the SZ operator, which means I get no sine inversion. I get 2 pi j IZ SZ. And that means if I apply two pulses at the same time, then the coupling, the heteronuclear coupling, evolves. Okay? And now, at last, I look at homonuclear coupling. That is situations A and Z and C. So here I have 180 degree pulse from X on I on now a different operator, 2 pi j I1 Z I2 Z. And now the 180 degree pulse inverts this first operator. It inverts the second operator. So two minus signs give a plus sign. So I get, after application of the pulse, I don't change the operator. So homonuclear coupling evolves. Homonuclear coupling cannot be refocused. Do you have questions? This is on the internet page. So we have two spin systems. Two spin systems can have a coupling between spin 1 and spin 2. And the coupling can be homonuclear or heteronuclear. And if I have a heteronuclear system, I draw two lines, one for the I spin, one for the S spin. I come back to the technical requirements for drawing these two lines in a minute, what that means. But let's, for time being, I somehow can pulse on one spin and the other spin. And I can, for example, be a proton, S can be carbon, 13C and or 15N. And now we have these echo sequences. And the echo sequences have a 180-degree pulse and two equally long time periods. And we now look what happens for coupling IS. Or in principle, what happens with chemical shift, heteronuclear coupling, homonuclear coupling. And we assume that we start here with IX magnetization. And now what I just said is summarized here. So chemical shift is refocused, heteronuclear coupling is refocused, homonuclear coupling evolves during delta half plus delta half, evolves during delta. And this is then explained here with this mathematical description that that was explanation number two. And we're going to add to this explanation number three. So we're going to update this spin echo thing. And then you see what happens to the individual stuff that I don't want to repeat because I just said this. I just wanted to point you to or draw your attention to this summary because it is kind of important. Once you understand what happens with delta, 180 delta, you understand how to design NMR experiments. And this is the way it is. So you have to, you know, if you want to, if you want to accustom yourself with this idea, how do you do that? You have to learn this. I mean, if you say I make this Vorlesung, this lecture, and then it's fine, then you learn it for a short period of time, and then you can also forget it. But if you continue doing NMR EPR, then you need to know that. Okay. So dann kann ich das hier. Now, where are these elements important? They are important for heteronuclear experiments. And where do we do heteronuclear experiments? Why do we do heteronuclear experiments? How do we do this? So, first, technical aspects. Aspects of heteronuclear NMR. So, we remember that the probe, the NMR probe, contains a copper wire, which is the RF circuit that actually applies pulses to the NMR sample and also detects the signal that the sample emits. Some words on English words, because very many people make this wrong. In German, there is a Probenkopf. And many people translate Probenkopf. This is the part that is actually put into the NMR magnet from below. This is where this wire is, Probenkopf. They translate this as probe head. Probe head is actually wrong. It is called probe. But if you say probe head, that's also fine. And then there is die Probe. And in English, die Probe is sample. So Probe. English is sample. So in the NMR and this glass thing where you put your chemical and dissolve it in chloroform, that is the NMR tube. Das Probenröhrchen. NMR tube, the glass thing. So you put your sample into an NMR tube, put a solvent in it, insert it from the top into the NMR spectrometer. By the way, little joke, there was this guy that actually inserted the sample in the NMR, didn't understand why there was no signal because he took this Eppendorf and or Erlenmeyer-Kolben and poured the liquid in the NMR spectrometer, and then there was no signal. There was never a signal. Yeah. Catastrophe. So if we use a little glass tube where we put our sample in, and that glass tube is actually inserted, and actually there's only one way of inserting it. It's like this. You cannot insert it like this for some reason. And so this NMR tube is in the NMR spectrometer, and then there's this copper wire that actually sends our pulses and detects the pulses. And the wire is tuned, is the RF circuit is optimized for example for detecting the frequency of 600 megahertz for protons. And then you can, but that's then the end of the story, you can have a second wire, yellow wire, and that can be tuned, for example, to 13C or 15N. So you have a white wire, which is the inner wire, or inner coil, and you have the yellow wire, which is the outer coil, and you can tune these coils such that they are optimized to detect specific frequencies. For example, protons or carbons would be 150 megahertz or something like this. And you get the most signal to noise the closer the wire is to the glass tube. That is kind of intuitive. Basically, my sample emits electromagnetic radiation, and I want to detect this radiation, and the closer I detect the radiation to the source of the emission, the higher is the signal to noise. So the inner wire, the inner coil, has highest signal to noise, and the outer coil has lower signal to noise. That's important if you are in Goebel or Wagner or Terfurt or whatever Arbeitskreis, and you send a sample to the NMR spectrometer. One of these probes costs between 100,000 euro and 300,000 euro. And so we have all in all 16 different spectrometers on campus. PR and bragging, there's no other place in the world that has more spectrometers than Frankfurt, brackets closed. But you can imagine that you cannot have all probes everywhere, all optimized probes everywhere. So on some spectrometers, you put in the inner coil the proton frequency. And that's best if you want to detect protons, if you want to do a proton experiment. And on some probes, you put the inner coil to be carbon. And that's then best if you want to detect carbon. And that you need to know. So you send your sample, depending on what you want to see, you send this to a 300 megahertz, where the coil is such that proton is optimized, or to a 250 megahertz, where carbon is optimized. And even if it's 50 megahertz less, your signal to noise is better if you go to a dedicated carbon inner coil probe. Understood? It's not difficult, but it's a lot of words that I have to make. Okay. Now, so that are technical aspects of heteronuclear NMR. Next point is, what determines signal to noise in NMR? So the signal to noise depends on a number of factors, and I try to discuss that with you one after the other, okay? Signal to noise is proportional to the gamma of the excited spin, and it's proportional to the power of 3/2 of the gamma of the detected spin. I won't explain to you why it is 3/2, because that is complicated. But I can explain to you why these gammas are important. Now, what was gamma? What was gamma? Gamma is the gyromagnetic ratio. And we had a spin of 1/2. And the spin rotates and induces a magnetic field. And the proportionality constant between the spin and the magnetic field is gamma. So we wrote down, if you remember, gamma I equals gamma, sorry, magnetization equals gamma spin. So the spin of protons is 1/2, and the spin of carbons is 1/2. So their I vector is kind of identical, but the induced magnetic field, that is what we detect, is for carbon is this vector, while for proton it's 4 times the vector. So this is I, and this and the blue and the yellow vectors are the induced magnetic field. And that comes about because the proton gyromagnetic ratio is 4 times larger than the carbon gamma. I cannot really explain why that is. Why is the proton gamma so much larger than the carbon gamma? At this point, we have to accept this. Proton is more sensitive than carbon. There's also physics, nuclear physics behind this, but I break this and I don't discuss it. We just accept that the gammas are different. Now, what is the effect that the gamma is different? Or where do we see that? Now, effect of gamma. Now, first of all, our Larmor frequency, the distance between the two energy levels, this distance, the Larmor frequency, depends on gamma. Okay? So if this is the proton difference in frequencies, then carbon, the difference in carbon is 1/4 of the difference in protons. Now, what is the effect of the differences in the energy levels between carbon and proton? Can you follow me, or does this become too complicated? The energy difference governs Boltzmann distribution. So the larger the difference, the more spins I have in the alpha state as opposed to the beta state. And if I write down that this is linear with the number of excited spins, then for the experts, you remember that the Boltzmann is an E hoch something expression, and you can actually develop every E function by a Taylor expansion series, 1 plus gamma linear term plus quadratic term and so forth. And this is the high spin approximation where you abbreviate the Boltzmann distribution after the first linear term. But, you know, that is just as an aside. But what you have to, or what I would like you to understand and take with you is that, of course, the larger the difference in the energies, the more signal-to-noise I get. And you see that I can change this by changing gamma. Clear, I go from carbon to proton, then I have a factor of 4 more signal-to-noise, as far as excitation is concerned. Or I can change the magnetic field. So I go to larger and larger and larger magnetic fields. And this is why we try to get more and more larger fields, because we increase the signal to noise. So this is the effect of gamma on excitation. So I'll write down excitation. And now, the effect on detection is that I have induced my magnetization that rotates, and the amount of RF that a proton sends out by rotating is 4 times larger than the RF sent out by carbon, because this vector is 4 times larger. So I just have more magnetization. The magnetization vector is longer. So I have more magnetization that a proton sends out than a carbon. So the induced field the induced magnetic field depends on gamma. So these are the first two factors. But there are more factors. we discussed that I can change gamma and get a higher, a better Boltzmann factor, or I can increase the magnetic field, I get a better Boltzmann factor. Again, one has a weird 3 over 2 power dependence on the field. That, again, I don't want to discuss. That becomes too complicated. But here, I have a factor which is the number of spins or number of molecules. Or I should say, yeah, number of molecules and number of spins. And I repeat what I have said once before, but I like this calculation and I would also like you to be able to make such a calculation. In NMR we typically use a 1 millimolar sample and 0.5 milliliters of that, which means 1/2 × 10^6. This milli is 10^3. I have that twice. It's 10^-6. 1/2 of this. This is the amount of sample I need. Times the Loh Schmidt number is 6 × 10^23. So a good number to know by NMR how much sample I need is 3 × 10^17. Molecules. Now depending on which spin I look at, not all of the molecules are NMR active. For protons it's 99.97. For carbon it's 1.something%. And for nitrogen, it's 0.3%. So if I say I need a 1 millimolar sample to run a carbon experiment, then the numbers of active molecules are only 1% of this, which means it is 10 micromolar inactive molecules. Or in nitrogen, it is 3 micromolar, 0.3%, is going down another factor, 3 micromolar amount of active molecules. So I have to also calculate natural abundance. Now, with natural abundance, you can change. You can make molecules that have 100% carbon. And we do that. And that's something if you do a bachelor or a master thesis or a doctorarbeit, PhD thesis in the lab, you use molecular biology methods to express proteins in isotope-labeled form. Or you can apply chemical synthesis to get 100% carbon. All of this is done, or is done, it's important. So you can combat natural abundance, but, for example, if you isolate a natural product from natural sources, then you have the natural abundance, and you can't do anything about this. And I like this number very much because it's 10^17 molecules that NMR needs. And other people like Heilemann are doing single molecule fluorescence with a single molecule. So it's just a factor of 10^17 more molecules that we need. On the other hand, we get more information. The single molecule is a very singular distance that you get. But anyway, I mean, you see the difference in the amount of sample you need for a specific technique. And it's not on me to explain to you the beauty of single molecule, but if you are able to detect single molecules, you can ask questions about the behavior of an ensemble of molecules that you cannot possibly answer with ensemble methods. Because with ensemble methods, all what you measure is always the most probable ensemble state of a system. Yeah? An NMR sample is an average of 10^17 molecules. So you can have probably lots of molecules that are totally different than these than the average, but you see the average. And you can also you should also make a back of the envelope calculation how many molecules are aligned in a crystal structure. Yeah, there you actually have frozen in all this averaging. Okay, so that's a nice discussion. Now comes a point that I also want to discuss, namely the number of experiments in Bruker language. One says number of scans. So how often do I do a 1D experiment? How often do I repeat this? And signal to noise in all spectroscopies goes with the square root, mit der Quadratwurzel, with the square root of the number of experiments I do. And I don't know, has this been explained to you, why you only get a square root? Can you explain? No. It has been discussed? Should I discuss again? Because it's quite... it's actually quite, if you think about the consequences, it's frustrating. So you make an experiment, one experiment, single shot experiment. You have signal. Signal should be 1 unit. You make the experiment again. Signal is at the same position because you do the experiment exactly the same time, same way. You have waited long enough for all relaxation to take place. You repeat the experiment. It's identical experiment. You again get signal of 1. So signal adds up. With number of scans times individual signal, which I have set arbitrarily to 1 unit. It's 1 photon. So now I have noise. And this is not a nice drawing. So noise, you have noise in all in all devices that you use to detect a signal, at all frequencies. So you have very low frequency noise that you can filter off. You can make a low pass filter to filter off low frequency noise. You can have a filter that filters off high frequency noise. But you cannot have a filter that filters the noise in the frequency range where your signals come, because you would also filter away the signals. So, I mean, that you live with noise. And if you have white noise, then white noise is randomly distributed around the line 0. So when you repeat the experiment, if your noise in the first experiment had a value of +1, in the second experiment you have the chance of 0.5 that the noise adopts a value of 0.1. And, I mean, simplistically, and you have the chance of 0.5 that it adopts -1. But it can also adopt all values in between. So the noise of the sum adds up with square root of the number of scans times noise of the individual experiment. And if you now make the ratio of signal over noise, you get the square root in. Yeah? So noise is random if it is white noise. And white noise, the definition of white noise is that it is randomly distributed top and above and below 0. Now, if you look at your spectra And some of you who have already analyzed spectra and you go with the threshold up and down, you see stripes, for example, in the vertical direction, or you see stripes in the horizontal direction. And that is not white noise. There are systematic errors to it. And in these regions, you have different problems. It's systematic, not white noise. But in the areas where you don't have these stripes in the vertical or horizontal regime, then you have white noise, and then this noise level should have equal probability to be above or below zero. Okay? So it goes with the square root. And that holds true for every spectroscopic technique. What is the consequence of that? Let's assume you want a signal-to-noise of you have a signal-to-noise of 4, and your chef says, "Well, you know, if you have a signal-to-noise of let's make it easier. You have a signal-to-noise of 10, and that means that whether you have an impurity of 10%, you can no longer detect, because if your signal-to-noise of your main product is 10, then the 10% impurity has a signal-to-noise of 1, which is just at the signal-to-noise. So we want to now detect, be able to say, we have less than 5%, we have less than 5% impurity. So we have to run the experiment longer. So we need to get a signal-to-noise of 100, factor of 100, of 10 more signal-to-noise. Then you can ask the question of how long would that take to increase the signal-to-noise by a factor of 10. So that the measurement time increases by 10 to the power of 2. So if you have measured 10 minutes for signal-to-noise of 10, you measure 10 times 10 minutes, 100 minutes for a signal-to-noise of 100. So it goes with the square, okay? Which means if you have measured 3 days and you get a signal-to-noise of 3 to 1, and your chef says, "I want to have want to characterize 5% impurity," you can say, "Well, fine, but I don't know how. It just ain't work." It goes exponential. It's the measurement time. Okay. Then there's a factor of temperature. The higher the temperature, the less sensitive the experiment. And there's a factor of T2. The sharper the line, the more sensitive the experiment. Okay, so this is signal to noise. So what people realized was, if I want to get the best sensitivity, I have to excite the spin with the highest gamma, and I have to detect the spin with the highest gamma. That would be protons. I have to build NMR probes where my inner coil is a proton coil and my outer coil is a carbon coil. And these probes, NMR probes, Probenköpfe, were built in 1986-87 for the first time, where you could have in the inner coil proton and in the outer coil carbon. So before that, you could not do experiments where you would excite and detect protons. But if you have that, then the following experiments are in principle feasible. then if I have such a probe, it should be possible to do an experiment where I start with proton, I somehow transfer magnetization on carbon, then evolve chemical shift, and then go back to proton. So I would excite proton and detect proton. That would be cool, because I take the highest gamma nucleus for excitation and the highest gamma nucleus for detection. And I have to think, is there some way of transferring magnetization of a proton to a carbon? Now, we of course know that there is a J coupling between proton and carbon. So there is a magnetic interaction between proton and carbon. And the 1J coupling, HC, is of the order of 150 hertz. Can be 120 for methyl groups. It can be 250 for aromatic protons bound to aromatic carbons, but let's say 150 hertz. And it was known that the T2 times of carbons can be of the order of 1 second. So very long compared to 150 hertz. So in principle, it should be possible to do that. And then Bodenhausen, together with Rubin, said, well, I actually, such a sequence, which is called inept, should transfer magnetization from a proton to a carbon. And the inept sequence is the basic building block in an HSQC. So HSQC you have already analyzed, and we now discuss today, but then repeat this and more on this next lecture on Friday. In inept should actually be a way of correlating these spins. Now, what have we learned with respect to the evolution of chemical shift and J couplings? Now, first of all, the inept, all experiments start with proton. I now write HZ. I leave this I and S and change for H and C to actually annotate or denotate my spins. So this is at the beginning, at point A, I always have equilibrium magnetization, the 90 degree pulse on protons from X does what it always does. It generates minus HY magnetization. And now I have the periods between B and C, and that is such an echo period. Delta half, 180 degree pulses, delta half. And now you don't know by heart as of now, but you could you know how we can calculate this. In such a period, delta chemical shift of a proton is refocused. Chemical shift, sorry, I should write proton. Chemical shift of a carbon is refocused, but carbon is also not transverse, so it doesn't really matter, but it would also be refocused. And now we have two pulses. So the J coupling evolves. One pulse would refocus the J coupling. Two pulses on proton and carbon lets the coupling evolve. J IS evolves. By the way, J proton-proton, homonuclear coupling would also evolve, but we don't care for that at this point in time. Okay, so we know that between B and C, we have to write down what happens with heteronuclear coupling between protons and carbons, HZ, CZ, and that evolves for 2 times delta, half for delta. Okay? And we have learned what happens. So it's HY cosine pi J CH delta plus 2 HX CZ sine pi J CH delta. Now I set delta to 1 over 2 J CH. This is for 150 hertz coupling, it's 3.4 milliseconds. And then I get minus HY cosine pi half J pi half plus 2 HX CZ sine pi J half. Sorry, the J is gone. Pi half. Because the J cancels. Yeah? Now, pi half is 90 degree. Cosine of 90 is 0. Sine of 90 is 1. So I have 2 HX ZZ. So at this point, I have 2 HX CZ. And now so I'll write it down, 2 HX ZZ at point C. And now I apply 2 pulses. A Y pulse, 90 degree pulse on protons, and an X pulse on carbon. I have the 2 coils. I can do that. I can do that simultaneously. I can do it one after the other. Let's do it one after the other. So I first apply a 90 degree pulse from Y on protons. So then Y pulse on proton X magnetization makes minus HZ. 2 times minus 2 times HZ ZZ. And then I apply a 90 degree pulse from X on carbon. X on Z also does a minus sign. So I get plus 2 HZ CY. And so this element of an echo, delta half, 2 pi pulses delta half, plus 2 90 degree pulses, has converted proton magnetization, transverse magnetization, into such a magnetization there where the carbon is transverse. And all of this takes 3.4 milliseconds, and I have 1 second to play games. So I can excite such a state. And so this is the first part of the of this HSQC. And now there's also a fundamental aspect in NMR, symmetry in pulse sequences. So if I mirror this sequence, so 290s, delta half, 280s, delta half, 190 on the protons, I do the reverse. I do exactly the same, the opposite direction. So I just have to repeat the mirrored pulse sequence, and I go back to protons. It's easy. And the fundamental aspect is just to see if I do that and if I apply symmetry, it must go back as long as my magnetization has not relaxed. Yeah? I mean, if it's relaxed, it's gone. Okay, so I know already from very, very simple, if I think, I mean, everything is easy once you know the solution. It's really, 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 really missed, shitty. It's like, do you do um die Ecke gedacht, Zeiträtsel? Some of you may do that. It's very easy. Once you know the solution, it's very easy, but you can spend hours on thinking about this, the solution. Anyway, so if I do this mirrored the other time, I go from this state again back to this state. And the only thing, and that's for the next lecture, what I now have to do is I have to understand how I evolve carbon chemical shift. And then I have a correlation that correlates a proton with a carbon by virtue of a 1J coupling. So I know this proton is coupled to this carbon. I get information that's important for chemists. And I do this with enormous signal, better signal to noise. So the signal to noise that is better is proton, proton instead of carbon, carbon. So it's proton 5 over 2 times power to the 5 over 2 times more sensitive than if I were to detect carbon directly. And that is a factor of, I think, 100 times square measurement time is 100 times 100 is 10,000 times more sensitive than if you do the, if you do it the other way around. Okay, and that's what we discussed, what we wanted to discuss today, and next Friday we're going to reconvene. Thank you.